teach as a kind of human rights worker. I think it's a mistake to pull kids in one direction. It's a measure of success for a few, but not everyone. Everyone does matter.
Firstly, I have to say that this conversation meant a lot to me because I have been a massive fan for a long time. To speak to one of my heroes and, I don't know, angel artists for me is just, I mean, this is why I love this podcast, Bob and Roberta Smith. It is not two people, everyone. It's one person. It's Bob. And Bob's not even called Bob. He's called Patrick. And it is just one of those conversations where I've been deeply moved and hopeful because Bob, Patrick, reminds us of how powerful creativity is. I'm not saying it's the answer to everything, but creative thinking outside of galleries and studios and workshop, I'm talking about true creativity, the way that we imagine the world, the curiosity that we should instill in our children is maybe the key and the answer to the world that we're living in or the scary future that we believe our children are going to be within, the AI bubble. And I know so often that creativity is also thought as a nice to have, but as Bob Patrick says, we need to have it. It is part of what makes us human. And we speak intently on this subject. He grew up in this artistic household. He had this world of sign writing. He's now in a garden in Chelsea Flower Show. It's one of those podcasts that will take your mind to lots and lots of places. But for anyone raising, teaching, or championing a child at home, you must listen to this because we're forgetting that creativity is not just about being good at art. It's actually about being human. And so listen to this podcast, feel empowered, follow everything that Bob Patrick says to follow. I'm going to do the same, and you're going to hear much more of me speaking of this subject in Holly & Co's future. Enjoy.
Bow your head and let your eyelids close on down. Where we're going, you won't need to bring your frown.
Hi, I'm Holly Tucker, and welcome to my podcast, Conversations of Inspiration. I've reached out to founders and those who simply inspire me to share their hard-earned wisdom with you. My hope is that collectively, these remarkable realizations will help you on your own journey. I like to think of it as inspiration for life. So let's begin this week's conversation of inspiration. Hello. Firstly, I have to say what a huge pleasure it is to meet you properly, Bob. We're big fans here at Holly & Co. I've just told you that this team is absolutely the eking and the noises that came out of the team meeting when I said that I'm interviewing you was like no one else. So you have had a huge effect already, but welcome to Conversations of Inspiration.
That's very kind of you. I'm not quite sure what to do with that information, but it's fantastic.
Well, we're just so, so happy to have you. You're a custodian of the arts, an absolute hero to many, and especially parents and children, for all that you're doing to encourage creativity. And you've been making waves in the art world for decades. So it is such a privilege to talk to you. I wanted to just start off, though, because I saw that you've been at Chelsea Flower Show as part of the Hospital Field Arts Garden. Hospital Fields Arts is a charity and it was a collaboration with them. But how was that? Is that your normal group of people that you're with? And, you know, what was that experience like?
No, it was absolutely wonderful and surprising. And I hadn't quite realized what I was getting into. But I spent the press day talking to extraordinary people like Floella Benjamin. I mean, all the people who came in to see me in my sort of studio in the garden were all really lovely. And it was great fun. And we hung out with Patrick Grant and Aid Edmondson. And I know all sorts of interesting people, yeah. And it was Vic Reeves.
Oh, really? Of course.
Orla Keeley came and she... And what was very interesting is that she came when we weren't there and she photographed the whole studio and took photographs of herself with the All Schools Should Be Art Schools sign. And I didn't know that. But then afterwards, we went to a bar and she was there. And my wife said to her, "Oh, you've got a lovely All Akili dress on." And she said, "I am All Akili." And anyway, 5 bottles of champagne later, we became great friends.
It helps, doesn't it?
It was a really lovely time. And the chap Nigel Dunnett, whose garden I was in, was a lovely man and somebody I've admired for a long time since. Weirdly, we both had something to do with the Olympics. I mean, he had much more to do with it than I did. He did all the gardening, all the planting for the Olympics, and I designed the Paralympic poster. So we kind of sort of knew each other about each other, but it was lovely to collaborate. And I mean, I had a wonderful time, and I'm quite a keen gardener myself.
Are you?
I mean, I'm a very bad gardener, but I love gardening, and I'm more of a hollyhocks, hydrangeas, and roses person than Nigel Dunnett. But it was wonderful.
Yeah, I can imagine he was teaching you a few things. Those who haven't seen what you did, just describe it, because it was slogans like "Gardens are the new galleries," and so describe what would have happened if one of our listeners was walking in to Nigel's garden and seeing your shed, wasn't it? The studio at the end.
Yeah. Well, the idea was to create a kind of humanistic creative space. It was also to create a bit of an exemplar, because the garden goes up to Lady Lone Primary School in Arbroath after it's been assembled there now. And it was to say, really, all schools, you know, in a small way, to say all schools should be art schools, and to create a creative space for this primary school, specifically, firstly, to look at Nigel's garden, to study the plants, mm-hmm. to think about the terrain, but also beyond that, to look at the world. So the studio, this it all becomes very metaphorical at this point, but the studio becomes a window on the world, and the students, what's inside the studio really is the children's imagination. You know, that's the idea. So it's a bit of a long-winded concept to talk to people at the garden about, but actually lots of people got it and really enjoyed it. People enjoyed just Nigel's planting, really, in a very way in which you'd understand other people's gardens, but it was quite a sort of philosophical garden, if you like.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a very, very enjoyable and fun time.
I can imagine. There's so many things I want to talk to you about. I'm going to have to like rein myself in, literally. Like the team were like, "Holly, keep yourself together with this." So I'm going to go back sort of to your childhood. And I wanted to ask you, though, to start this sort of journey off. Your real name is Patrick Brill, and you spent your early years growing up in Yorkshire with your parents, Frederick and Deirdre, and your sister, Roberta. And talking of Roberta, can you just tell us how the name Bob and Roberta Smith came into existence? For all of you who thought I was about to interview two people, it is just one amazing human. So over to you. It was a collaboration, wasn't it?
Well, my sister, I had two sisters, one sadly not with us anymore. But Roberta is still with us. And she went to art school. In fact, my other sister, Charlotte, went to art school. We all went to art school. And I went off to America. I lived in New York for a couple of years. And really, my sister, Roberta, she stopped making art, really, and had a family. And I thought if I collaborated with her again, that would get her making art again. So for a brief time, we did collaborate. And that was when I began to get some sort of recognition, started working with galleries, and I started working with the Anthony Wilkinson Gallery. And then she retrained to become first a psychiatric nurse and then a group psychotherapist. Mm. And she spent her life, a working life, working in mainly women's prisons, doing extraordinary therapeutic work. So she's an amazing person, but But I kept the idea of Bob and Roberta Smith because I liked it. A lot of our work to begin with, and still is, the idea of creating a workshop. And in the workshop, even the signs that I make are a bit like that. You know, I'm not really telling people how to live their lives or what to think. What I'm making is provocations, and they're sort of instructions in a workshop. That's how I see them.
Yeah, okay.
And the idea is really that anybody could take part in the workshop. So the idea is really, it's a bit like Doctor Who or 007. You can be Bob and Roberta Smith. So by having Bob, keeping the name, the idea was to say everybody could take part and be Bob and Roberta. And for a short time in the 1990s, I had Japanese Bob and Roberta and German Bob and Roberta.
No, you did. Oh, my gosh.
I did. And they were making work and sending it to me and saying, is this okay? And I'd be going, of course it is. You know, it's Bob and Roberta Smith work.
Oh, my God. I love
So the
that.
Idea was, it was promoting the idea that anybody could make art, really.
And I also read that you said, you know, she can be seen as a bossy sister. And I did think my sister might absolutely agree that the older sister can be a little bit bossy. And I love that sort of concept of the, well, we're going to keep talking. This is what I would say is the golden thread throughout everything that you've done, actually, which is the sort of, it's about other people. It's about, you know, allowing art to be free. And so it's even in your name. I know when you were growing up, you had early exposure to the art world because now hearing all family members basically went to art school because your parents were both artists. Your dad, Frederick, was the head of the Chelsea School of Art. And I read when researching you before becoming an artist, your dad worked for the Blue Band Margarine Factory. And he also sold vegetables at North End Road Market as well. And so can you just tell me, how did he move from that margarine into the world of art? And what was it like growing up in that sort of, you know, literally a cocoon of creativity? Because I thought it's maybe the assumption could be, and I know you've spoken about it, about working class background, you won't be able to make a living in the arts. And yet your whole household sort of, you know, dispelled that myth.
Yeah, I wish I know more about my mother's journey into the arts than I do about my dad's, really. But because my dad died when I was quite young. But I've always found this remarkable, you know, and very quite emotional, really. But somebody must have said to him, you really like drawing. You know, it must have been his art teacher. You're really like drawing. You're really good at it. You ought to pursue this. And the whole system was very different then. You know, he went to art school when he was 14. But the idea, I mean, it was a totally different world. There were lots of trades in the arts that working people could be involved in.
Yep.
And both my parents, because they came from working class backgrounds, they were pushed initially to do things in design, really. My dad in graphic design and my mum first in tailoring and then dressmaking and then in graphics. But there was a kind of threshold, a way of saying, you know, this is important work. And you could see, like now with digital media, really, you could see we do need masses of people who are visually literate to engage in the world of digital technology. So, but in those days, it was getting kids who are good at the arts to have a visual sense and go on and study. I'm very interested in all this because I've met my, you know, I know my dad's family and they're all really interesting people, but none of them have gone off in the arts like that. He was really quite a unique sort of individual, and his brother, you know, it's the kind of classic thing, his brother did boxing for a little while, and that was going to be his route out. I don't think, I mean, a route out, that's patronizing, isn't it? I don't think it was really like that, but certainly art education was a life-changing thing for both my parents, yeah.
And also, I mean, but, and I know you didn't, not necessarily, but just to go from, the Blue Band Margarine Factory to the head of the Chelsea School of Art. I mean, that is some sort of, he must have been talented.
Yeah, what's really amazing about it is that he, the Blue Band Margarine Factory was in Fulham, and he grew up in Fulham, but then he ended up running Chelsea School of Art, and one campus of it was on Bagley's Lane, which is in Fulham, very close to where he lived as a child. And I never really got to ask him about all this, really, but it really is they were both really quite remarkable people. And he was incredibly driven about art. You know, for me, I like to have a bit more fun than my dad, but my dad's idea of making art was tying himself to a hillside
in North Yorkshire
in the pouring rain and carefully studying the light. Whereas, that's not my... It's part of my shtick, but it's not the whole of my shtick. So he was very serious about it.
Yeah, and I think about that morning, you know, get up, school, get up. And yet there you all are, sitting around the breakfast table, you know, basically all artists at heart. And your mum drew you a picture of a Christmas pudding and asked you to think about all the ingredients that went into it, who might be sitting around the table, who might be eating it. And she said, art is an invitation. And I would love you to tell me about that, because I know it's shaped the way in which you've approached art in your life. And I'll say it again, art is an invitation. I've really thought about that this morning. Like, what a beautiful short statement that says so much.
Yeah, it was a very, I think about it, it's a very philosophical thing to say, but it was a very everyday thing for my mum to say.
Yeah.
So a little bit about my mum. She grew up in Margate, and she was evacuated when Dunkirk happened. And ended up going to the Royal College during the Second World War, where she met my dad. And my grandfather was a plumber in Margate. And of course, when the war happened, being a plumber in Margate is about fixing the taps in every bedroom in the boarding houses. And of course, that ended. And but he had an engineering background, and so he went and worked in making munitions in the Second World War. I mean, I know a lot more about my mum's experience of art and that journey. And it was the small art school in Margate that she went to that really turned her onto the arts. But initially, it was going to work in Savile Row. So she travelled up to Savile Row. It's going to be a pattern cutter.
Really, yes.
But she didn't enjoy it. You know, there's too many rules.
Yes.
And it was, it wasn't what she wanted to do. So she went down the graphics route. And then she went to the Royal College. And at the Royal College, painting was for blokes, really.
Yes.
It was a serious business for blokes. And so she had a real fight to join the painting department, but never looked back. She was making paintings all of her life. She was quite successful in making paintings and sold them and, you know, made a living out of it. I mean, the amazing thing about my childhood, which is very weird, I can see it's quite weird, but every plate of food on our table, you know, everything was provided by the arts, you know, food. Teaching, but also through selling work and selling paintings. And
wow!
So I just thought that's what people did. I thought people made stuff, they sold it, and then they had a living. You know, lots of people.
Little did you know,
but we don't think about that. You know, actually crafting something. You know, it makes it, I mean, it's one of the reasons why art makes you powerful, is that it gives you a kind of independence, really.
Yeah, and confidence, maybe, in yourself, right? We talk so much, don't we? And we're going to talk about the future towards the end of this podcast, but we talk so much nowadays about lacking confidence or, you know, all these things. We're getting so deep into understanding our brains more and more and more and more. And I think art plays a phenomenal role in giving people confidence of the DNA that they were blessed with and who they are and their uniqueness. But let me keep going with you, because I want to get to the sign writing phase and New York as well. You mentioned it before. you went, were nurturing, you led you to art school, and then you went to New York, where you said, and it was, I can only imagine New York at that time, where you trained as a sign painter in the late 80s. I mean, pretty cool. What was that like? New York 80s had a reputation, didn't it, of being such a vibrant melting pot of, I don't know, culture, creativity, innovation. What was the move to sign writing?
Well, I've been interested in, I mean, one of the big things in my life has also been this sort of relationship with music.
Really?
And when I was a kid, you know, transcribing the lyrics off the back of albums and trying to understand what pop music lyrics were, was a big thing with me. And even at school, I was making paintings, which were a bit like, you know, they were kind of like pop art, really, with lettering. But then when I went to art school, I went down a sort of different kind of route, really, and made more figurative paintings and did performances and sculptures. But it was really while I was in New York that lots of things came together. One was understanding how art fits in with popular culture in a way. Mm. And you'd think that was to do with pop art, but actually for me it was to do with a bit of an idea about pop art, but also a bit about folk art. And one of the huge things was that, one of the main thing that happened when I was in New York is I met Jessie, my wife.
Yes.
But one of the amazing things is that we drove across the States. And when you drive across the States, you know, you drive from a kind of commercial milieu, and then it evaporates, you know, and you get into Texas and New Mexico. And when you're driving through, you know, the states closer to New York, you think, oh, another Wendy's, another McDonald's. I don't want to go in there. But when you get out into the desert, you see a Wendy's and a McDonald's and you go, oh my God, I've got to go.
Thank goodness for Wendy's.
There's going to be proper bathrooms.
Yes.
There's going to be something that I can eat. I understand, you know. And it really was wild, you know. We went from driving across these baking hot deserts and then driving up to the Grand Canyon and it being absolutely freezing. We nearly, you know, came a cropper driving to the Grand Canyon, and we went from a day where it had been very hot to a day where it was very cold. But the thing about the sign writing, and a thing also about radio, is that there are lots of businesses advertising what they're going to do, and it's all about the border. You know, when you're and there'll be signs as you drive down the freeway saying, you know, it's 100 miles to this truck stop on the border, and then it's 50 miles the taco place or whatever it is. And then, so you're building up in your imagination, so the signs are getting bigger and wilder and telling you more things that are on display, you know, more things that you'll get there. And then you get into this place and it's a, you know, kind of mad cornucopia of capitalism. And then you drive away from it, and then you're on to the next one, you know. And then also listening to commercial radio, all these little places, you realise the whole of Southern California really is very Mexican. You know, it was Mexico at one stage.
Yeah.
And in Florida, down in that neck of the woods, you know, Cuban places advertising their rice and beans joints. And so it's kind of individualistic, mad desire to advertise something and say something and try and get people involved.
Yeah.
It really opened my eyes to that. You know, in England, signs are telling you to keep off the grass and to stop you doing things. But in America, of course, there's a bit of that. But in America, it's very different. It's trying to
entice you.
You know, it's trying to pull you in. And also quite homemade advertising, you know, I love all that. And that really turned me on to thinking, oh, there's something to say there a bit beyond the world of fine art and painting. You know, this is all painted art and it's vernacular, I suppose you'd call it vernacular art, but actually it's just, it's quite powerful because it's about desire. You
what
know?
A story.
So that really turned me on to that.
Thank you for telling me that. That it just makes so much sense. But now looking at your art, I'll really picture, you know, you drive hours listening to the radio, longing for the Wendy's. Do you know what I mean? And the toilet with toilet paper. And actually, that's where it comes from. And it's the old adage, isn't it, that you can't really connect the dots. You can only connect the dots looking backwards.
Also, I mean, it's a very privileged thing to say, but you can't really understand Carl Perkins and Elvis Presley until you've listened to them driving through Mississippi, you know. It's a totally different thing. It's great, you know. American culture is an amazing thing.
Oh.
I know it's a tricky place at the moment, but it is an amazing place.
Well, it is, yeah, exactly. It's not necessarily on my list at the moment, but I hope it will be in the future. Your sign painting training certainly obviously paved the way, and you're known for your brightly coloured typography art, often with a social and political sort of commentary. And as I said to you, I've got one of your pieces. I'm very, very lucky. I mentioned to you that it's one of my what I would call heirlooms that I will be passing on to my sole daughter Olive, because she's a creative 10-year-old, and we've always talked about your piece actually. You stood against Michael Gove in the 2015 election campaign to highlight the value of arts with the slogan, "All schools should be art schools." So I just want to ask you about that experience. You know, that speaks to me incredibly, and I know it speaks to a lot of people, and we're going to now talk about that. But I just want to talk about that experience when you were like, enough. You know, I'm going to do something about this.
Well, I'm completely shocked by what's happened to the arts in our schools post 2010. One of the things that happened when the coalition government appeared was, they'd run, both the Liberals and the Conservatives had run on a manifesto, but of course they had to create a new agreement to run the government. And of course, that gave Michael Gove saw that as an opportunity to bring in free schools and this idea of the EBAC and later Progress Aid. I have some sympathy with Michael Gove, really, because on some level he doesn't want kids patronised. You know, he wants kids to really understand, you know, mathematics and English, and so that they can succeed. And that is part of the job of education. But the downside of it was that he created a system of accounting for schools with league tables in which the EBAC was one of the factors. And the EBAC, you could only have one art subject within the EBAC.
And for those who don't know what an EBAC is?
Yeah, it's quite complicated, but it's 8 subjects that you can choose and that your child gets an EBAC. But that it's all a bit nonsensical, because I don't think any employers really look for the EBAC. But it's a way of schools being able to climb a EBAC league table, if you like, and a Progress 8 league table. It's all about limiting the subjects that kids do, so that the English and maths and the sciences have more preference, really. And it's a very brave head teacher who goes, "Oh, we're not going to do that. We're going to support the arts and let the kids do what they want." And the truth about education, I think, is that you should let kids and you should celebrate kids what they're interested in.
Yeah.
You know, because the kid who's fantastic in mathematics and is not really interested in the arts, my God, support them doing mathematics. That would be fantastic for them.
Yes.
But equally, the kid who's not that interested in mathematics, but is really great at the arts, you know, let them matriculate at some level in mathematics, but don't beat them up over their abilities, because they'll be amazing at, they'll find mathematical abilities through music or through pattern or some other way, you know. So I think, you know, we've got to support our kids in what they're great at and celebrate them. And if you did that, you'd find kids would be more successful. You'd find that they wouldn't have all these well-being issues that they have. Mm-hmm. And really, you know, the thing is, we've got to say to our schools, you know, get rid of the EBAC. Because one of the things is that, you know, if you're a really good at art and you're really good at music, you're probably quite interested in drama. And yes. You probably like darts. You know, yeah. Why don't they let them have GCSEs in all of those things? And they could do a mathematics qualification on the back burner, but let them really do the things that they're really into. And then they'll be successful at them, you know, and they will find jobs. And also the thing in art is that people are very resilient and they will create jobs. Mm. That's the thing. We're too much training kids up to exist in the world that exists now. But actually, if you get kids doing the arts, they will create the world of the future. You know, that's what they would do.
One of the things I'm most proud of at Holly & Co. is the fact that we're run by women, made by women, but open to all. Over 95% of the small businesses that sell on our marketplace are female-founded, and over 97% of our team is female, which means that every time you shop with us, you are voting with your money for the kind of world you want to live in. And by supporting women-owned businesses, you're backing the idea of flexible working, showing the next generation what's possible, and actively championing the female economy. It means that despite only 2 pence of every pound's worth of funding in the UK going to women, and women still being the primary caregivers, we are rising above and finding a new way to live life our way. You can support female-founded businesses by looking out for the badges on our website. In fact, we have lots of ways to shop by your values, from choosing black-owned businesses or socially positive businesses to products that are made of recycled material or crafted here in the UK. If you care about where you shop, discover more at holly.co. For now, though, let's get back to our conversation of inspiration. What makes your work so powerful? It is a campaign. It makes us feel something, like the very best way that art does. And one of the themes that runs through your work alongside the political and social messages is this sense of playfulness as well, which I think, going back to what your mum said, you know, it's an invitation because it allows us in. It feels very familiar. I feel like it's a friend of mine. I feel, do you know what I mean? It has that sense, and it has a sense of, I think, hopefulness and optimism. Is that important for you? Because this subject, I mean, we could do probably an entire podcast on the subject and be quite angry about it. And I want to keep talking to you about it now, but I feel very passionately about it, so I'm going to keep myself together. But It is absolutely horrific what's happening. But your work feels like I've got hope within it. Is that, again, that you're looking to stir emotions but also connect people rather than make them angry?
I think that idea of I don't know quite how to describe it really, but it goes back to my parents really, because I know that I know my family and my sister's families, you know, and everybody that I know in the arts, they are evidence of the positive glue that the arts are in society. And also a route to success. So I know from experience that that's the case. I don't particularly want to hang out with Michael Gove. You know, it's really about the issues, not the personalities. You know, they our current government, I thought would be a bit more, you know, we'd get rid of these things overnight. They haven't done that.
No, they haven't.
And so we're pushing against them. And a lot of those people are people that I know and more familiar with. But you still have to say to them, you know, you need to do the right thing. And also, what is happening is that, if I want to get angry about it, is that we're discriminating against creative kids. That's what we're doing. It's totally stupid, but that's what we're doing. And it's the Labour government are doing it as well, and the Conservatives did it in the past. Governments, middle management, all this sort of stuff, they're driven by sorts of strange ideas about accounting and data. But actually, if you thought of the heart of the issue, what we're doing is discriminating against kids and causing them to be unsuccessful and unhappy. It's not what we should be doing. So there is hope, you know.
But when you put it like that, and we talk about discrimination a lot in society, and we're talking about it continuously, so how is that not being seen through that lens? Because, you know, that is basically what it is. And if we want, and we're going to get more and more into this, but if we, you know, when we think about the future and we think about, and we're going to touch on AI and we're going to touch on these things in a moment, the point is that the humanness in us needs to be updialed, right? We need to be talking about the very thing that's one in 400 trillion chances of you being born. One in 400 trillion chances, every child is a miracle. We're miracles literally walking the planet. And that miracle was destined for something. All those cells put together in that unique formula that makes you, Bob, me, Holly, is what our path is. And so we have to nurture it in your garden. We have to nurture, don't we, the person that this is. And it's discriminating against those children who could go and create the next business, right, that is going to stand up against AI. And everyone's like, oh, no one, you know, humans are literally going to be the 21st century horses. Do you know what I mean? Like, we're maybe not.
Well, it's good that you mentioned the garden. I mean, when I was at Chelsea Flower Show, which is a mad place, really, but it's fantastic. But it is interesting to think about classrooms as gardens.
Yes.
And if you think of, I don't want to think of kids as plants.
Yes.
But, you know, we need to nurture every child. And actually, if you think about your garden, it has different requirements, you know.
Yes.
Different plants need different kinds of nurture. And, you know, things are for sandy soil. I don't want to extend this metaphor too far.
Yes.
But, you know, they have sandy soils, or you might want a bit of Johnny-ness number three, or whatever it was, on your different plants. And we really need to, some kids, you know, some kids need lots of water and nutrients, and some kids need, you know, dry soil or something, you know. But actually, if we thought about it like that and tried to play, instead of trying to get them to jump through this one hoop of perceived academic success, but thought about, actually, we want to create a garden which flourishes, where every kid flourishes. Mm. That would be a better way. I mean, good teachers do think like that. They do. They. Mm. I mean, I think teachers are kind of human rights workers. All teachers, you know, everybody in school is a human rights worker. But we don't want to, I think it's a mistake to pull kids in one direction and say that is a measure of success, because it isn't, and it makes lots of kids unhappy. It's a measure of success for a few, but not everyone. And actually, everyone does matter, you know, in all our diversity, you know.
Talking about this, I interviewed Kate Robinson, daughter of the late, great Ken Robinson, on this podcast a little while ago.
Oh.
And she put it so beautifully. She said that at its core, her dad's work was a celebration of what we as species are capable of achieving within the right conditions.
Mm.
And, you know, his famous, you know, story, I'm sure everyone knows about it. You know, the mum, you know, who is, my child has got an issue. I don't know. It's disruptive in the class, all these sorts of things. And he tells this beautiful story about, basically, I won't ruin it. People should go and listen to it. But ultimately, the school, recognizing that the kid had no issues whatever, put her in the right environment, and the mum looks and peers through the classroom door and sees her daughter dancing because she was always, it makes me emotional, she was always meant to be a dancer. Mm. That's what her diamond was. And it was a dull diamond at school. And the job of the school was to shine it.
Yes.
And then she could go and sparkle for her life. And that is, you know, when we look at the, what we're saying is it point systems, tiers, accounting, data, you know, tick boxes, all these things that we're obsessed about.
Mm.
You wonder if you allowed, going to your analogy of the garden, and that they were, you know, nurtured in the conditions that they needed to be nurtured in, it would blow away any score system, wouldn't it? It would, if it was looking at, I don't know, like I don't know, it would be the most successful. This is what people don't understand. Mm. You're actually shackling the potential of the country, of our children. If you want a prosperous world, if you nurtured everyone in the right way, you wouldn't even need that.
No.
You know, we would be going to the moon and back, literally, because those children's brains were being told, wow, I'm amazing at what I do. And who knows what that could create in terms of economy systems. And I thought that, you know, with your art, what you're saying, the underfunding of the arts, the rigidness of the assessments, the low status it's given, the sort of like, oh, your art. Do you know what I mean? It's like the math is the only thing that can win, is it, this day and age?
A couple of years ago, I went to an amazing primary school in near Leeds called Gomersall Primary School. There are other people doing this, but there's a wonderful teacher there called Mandy Barrett. Mandy Barrett had persuaded her head teacher. I mean, Mandy Barrett was a generalist teacher, but she had studied art, but she persuaded her head teacher to create an art room in the primary school. And I mean, this is the thing, really. I mean, all of these things need looking at, but the primary school is a key place, really, because it's quite, actually, it's quite difficult to teach the arts if you haven't been an artist in that way. Where do you start? What do you do? How do you do it?
Yeah.
So they've created this art room. But the brilliant thing about Mandy Barrett's art room is that it's not the exclusive place where the kids are taught, but she teaches all the subjects, all the other subjects in the school through the arts. So she's teaching mathematics by teaching them algorithmic drawings, by getting them to make paintings, by thinking about rhythm. She's teaching them geography by getting them to draw the landscape, but also to map the territory and draw stratigraphy, you know. She's teaching them English by getting them to think about, you know, kind of illustrations to stories. She's teaching them history by getting them to imagine the past. She's teaching them the sciences through thinking about ideas about chemistry and color and all this sort of, and biology and draw. And, you know, she's teaching all of these different subjects. And also she's teaching art as well.
Yeah.
And they're making great art, but what they're actually doing is developing their human intelligence with sheets of paper and pencils and paint and clay. And it's about intelligence. It's about our human intelligence. And those kids, they will be successful because they will see across the silo that we've created for all of these different subjects and see how intelligence is interconnected. And that's what we, that's really what education should be about, is being able to see how one facet of human society or one facet of the world is linked to another, because we're on, you know, we're in a universe that looks at everything.
Yes.
So Mandy Barrett, so that's
I now
my,
understand
please.
Your posters and your placards in the garden.
We need a Mandy Barrett art room.
Who is this Mandy Barrett?
I know, she's a hero. She's
and I was thinking, who is this? I felt terrible. It's like, I must know who this is. I love that you highlight that, and everyone have a look at the placards.
Well, I was really blown away by
Mandy
what she
Barrett's,
was doing.
I think
we
right.
do need. Yeah, she's. She's not the only person doing that. There are other schools pushing that, but that is an important way. If you know, if the Michael Goves of this world want to improve children's intelligence, they should be doing that, because that more than any other way will improve their mathematical abilities. Actually, if you have let's stick a piano in there as well.
Yeah.
Because if you get kids to think about music, you get kids to draw the world. I mean, drawing the world is about looking at the world.
Mm.
Joseph Albers said this. Joseph Albers, who kind of invented the Bauhaus, said that human beings, artists, we look at the world. We make a decision about it. You know, the decision is making a bit of art, making a drawing, and then we act upon it. You know, we think about that drawing and we then display it and stick it out in the world. And that idea of looking and understanding, assimilating the world by making a drawing and saying, well, actually, I can do, you know, art says to people, says to children, very young children, I can do something. I can actually contribute. I can make a contribution. And that's a wonderful thing. You know, if you just think of kids as sponges absorbing information, you're ignoring the bit where you're saying they can make a contribution. And we need kids to feel that.
You know? Gosh, you're so right. You mentioned, I just wanted to touch on that you said teaching art is akin to a human right. Art teachers are human right workers. And you said, rightly so, you know, all teachers who are brilliant teachers are fantastic. Schools incorporate, we all know about this, STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics into the curriculum. And we're obsessed with STEM. And you say we should teach STEAM, science, technology, engineering, art, and mathematics. And it's so simple, right? Just put the A in.
Well, by only teaching STEM subjects, you're doing that's discriminatory. I mean, that just is discriminatory, you know. And also, it's very blinkered. And also, art, I mean, the STEM idea is one that has caught hold in the kind of campaign. But actually, let kids do what they want. Let kids, I don't want to minimize mathematics or the sciences in schools. I think it's all wonderful, but really we mustn't minimize the arts in schools. It's a total mistake.
But you wonder if letting kids do what they want, you know, when we think back to, you know, education and the fact it hasn't changed in at least 100 years, you know, the way that we even learn, you wonder if just the first step. Wouldn't it be amazing that we could, if we're this island and we could cultivate anything we wanted to? And, you know, I always think back to the Olympics when we, that launch Olympic ceremony, right? And I just thought, this is where Britain is just cool. And imagine if we could recreate, I was talking to Tim Smith, founder of Eden, about this, you know, recreate agriculture, recreate, you know, education. How phenomenal that we could do that. We're born to do this sort of thing. But because we live in the world that we do live in and we have the people leading the way that they are, you just wonder if it's more palatable, just put the A in STEM, right? Just to start there. Because, you know, you see the problem is, you know, the impact of the arts not being funded in schools, the disadvantaged children are being affected the most in the arts. You said when reading, and I didn't know this, and when I was reading about you, that Germany, France and Finland are all increasing their arts funding, right? And they sort of, you know, certainly Scandinavian countries, you know, you definitely know they know what they're doing. Yet we've cut our budget, and that you were saying that how creativity is basically becoming a privilege, not a right. And what do you think that the real impact of this is going to be? I mean, firstly, I said your art gives me hope. Are you an optimistic person at heart?
I know, I'm a hugely optimistic person. I think it will be okay.
Okay. Do you think in your heart of hearts that potentially what you want, even just the A in STEM, might happen?
I think there's a good chance. There's a wonderful campaign called the Arts and Minds Campaign, which is run by the NEU. And I spoke to the NEU, which is the National Education Union in Harrogate. And they are, you know, they're really campaigning, pushing the government. You know, they're a labour organisation. Mm-hmm. Generally, they're pushing the government. And of course, it's embarrassing for the government to have the NEU really against them. So I think there are some levers that we can push at the moment, which we couldn't push before, because I think the government just didn't listen when it was a Conservative government. But now it does listen, but it's not doing anything because there's too many kind of middle managers involved in it all. Mm-hmm. That's a bit uninspiring. And they're scared of themselves, really.
Yes.
But I think there is a chance at the moment, and there's a real momentum going. I mean, I thought when the government changed that would be the end of all this campaigning, but actually it's more important now than ever that people push the government to, you know, I think, get rid of Progress 8 and get rid of the EBAT, these accounting mechanisms. Well, it doesn't need to cost them. It'll cost them a bit more, but it won't cost them very much more, really. It's really about love. It's the mood.
Yes.
And if you were to do that, you would open things up. The thing about the problematic thing is that all the independent schools know the value of the arts. Mm-hmm. I mean, not every single one of them, but most of them do. And they have lovely art rooms.
Yeah.
And they realize it's partly because if you're running an independent school that has kids staying overnight, you need something for them to do, after the school day's finished. So you can promote the arts and get the ones who are interested in that to engage in it. But the problem with that is that it's making the arts more and more privileged and actually really, the discrimination doesn't become against, I mean, I don't want to go on about the politics about it too much because it's a bit divisive, but the thing is, it's not just discrimination against the creative kids, it's discrimination against working people, really.
Yeah.
Because the people like my parents, they were encouraged to do the arts, weirdly, because there was an economy there, and there is again now, but there was an economy there that people, so their teachers said, well, go to art school. And that's what we ought to be saying to working class kids, go to art school, And the mums and dads, you see, they're terrified of that. They think their kids are never going
to get a job.
But they will. They will, and they will create work. They will create and be part of a real changing economy, They'll be part of that.
You being you, you've developed a program called Superpower of Looking. And it's sort of an antidote to everything that we're really talking about. And by the way, I absolutely love the phrase superpower of looking. It encourages curiosity that's so important for our children, that curiosity, not being scared of life, embracing it. And one of the things that really struck me about it was that it encourages us to slow down. You know, we live in this, I'm speaking to the converted, this Everything we consume is fast, and it's only getting faster. Children exposed to that media, TV, phones. Do they watch TV anymore? It's basically all in these tiny, tiny screens. And we've sort of lost the ability to slow down. And I talk about myself as well, right? Adults are just getting faster and faster, maybe overstimulated. Tell me about what Superpower of Looking is, and how does it work for anyone who doesn't know about it?
Well, the Superpower of Looking really comes out of Art UK. And I'm an ambassador of the Superpower of Looking and a patron of Art UK. Art UK is putting the nation's collections online. But one of its initiatives is an educative initiative, which is the Superpower of Looking. And the Superpower of Looking is all about something. I made a painting a few years ago called, which just says deep looking. And it's a kind of, it's just the phrase deep looking, but it's kind of painted on a slightly submarine kind of background. So you can you can imagine that you can imagine painting is about looking into space and seeing and trying to understand it, trying to understand what's there. Literally, this idea of a window in the world. And all paintings are a bit like that, and all art is like that. So the Superpower of Looking initiative is about making films of artists, but also people who are just fascinated by a particular painting. One of the films in the first tranche of Superpower of Looking was a lady who was a taxi driver looking at Paolo Uccello's painting in the National Gallery. And it was an amazing, lovely little film about her, her interest in it. And what is really interesting about all that is that, different people have different responses to the same painting.
Yes.
This is a little vignette of one person's response to the painting. I looked at Rousseau's surprise, the wonderful image of the tiger that Rousseau lovingly depicted. It was probably, a kind of imaginary scene based on the Botanic Gardens in Paris. But it's an amazing image. And when you look at it, it's actually a painting of a storm. So you can imagine the sound of the painting.
Mm.
But if you look at it, it's a powerful image. And you think, well, that's a tiger and he's hunting. But actually, the tiger's frightened by the storm. And you look at it and it reveals itself to you. And all paintings do that, because painting, it takes a long time to make a painting.
Yes.
It take the average time somebody spends in front of a painting in a gallery, somebody worked out, was 7 seconds. So they do bear more looking at.
Yes, yeah, yeah, they deserve more than 7 seconds of our time.
But it's saying to kids, you know, your mentality, your ability is important in the way that you look at things and how you understand things.
Yes.
And don't just take things at how they seem at first glance. You know, really think about them. Think about what you see. That's what it's saying.
Yes, think about what you see. You're right. And how can these, are you hoping that this is rolled into, I don't know, into all schools, you know?
It's a tool that is available to all schools right now.
Okay.
And they can just go to the Art UK website and follow the links for that. And you'll find there's all sorts of material. So it's been, they've been developing it. I was involved
Fantastic.
In the early stages of developing it, but it's grown and grown and grown. And one of the ideas is that the teacher can contact Art UK and show them the work that they've done through the superpower of looking. And they'll get a poster, and the poster I designed says, "I really like your paintings."
Oh my God.
But also, Brilliant. The idea, although it's based slightly on these examples, you know, the National Gallery or also in regional galleries on our national collections, it's not about really copying the work. One of the things, great things about this, I mean, this whole thing connects up for me because it's on a superpower of looking trip that I met Mandy Barrett and saw her amazing art room. But one of the things that Mandy was doing with the kids was saying, what's outside the painting? And so some of them were painting, you know, crocodiles and giraffes that the tiger might be after. And then some of them had got wind that actually it was a botanical park in Paris and they were painting trams and buses.
Wow.
So they were literally thinking, I know it's an overused phrase, but thinking outside the box of the painting to imagine what's going on in the next cage or the next space.
Yes.
Or the imaginative space. You
How
know?
Fantastic. How amazing.
It's a really lovely, it's very open-ended. It's not about copying these paintings. It's about getting people to think about it
and be lost in it and its imagination and creativity.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you know that Royal Mail have refreshed their small business hub on royalmail.com? The Small Business Hub contains relevant product information, insight, articles, tips, tricks, and more with small businesses like you in mind. You may even see me pop up there from time to time. Why not take a look and remember to keep popping back as it's regularly updated? You can find the Small Business Hub at royalmail.com/smallbusinesshub.
I wanted to speak to you about AI. I've mentioned it just briefly, but we've seen this explosion in the last few years of the rise of AI. And we're, you know, I talk about it often. We're all using AI all day long without even realizing it now. And so this is here to stay. And there's a huge response, though, recently to the government's proposal to allow AI companies to train their models using copyrighted works without permission, unless the owner opts out of it, right? So I've spoken to different artists about this, different illustrators, obviously myself, 20 years now representing creative small businesses in this country. You can imagine, you know, there is just this absolute jaw-dropping moment that this is being allowed. I'd love to know what your view is on this, because it's been a bit of a bombshell.
It's a nightmare, really. I mean, I think the thing is, it's you know, one of the things happening with AI is it's the latest, not just, it's not, it's a long journey. This is social media. It's to do with platforms, who owns the platforms, the agglomeration of
yes.
wealth and power within, out, away from governments
mm-hmm.
into allowing people to have huge, huge wealth, which is totally unaccountable.
Mm.
And AI for creatives, we're the latest victims of that, really. And we have to push against it. We have to push against it and own our own copyright. It's a business thing. Fundamentally, it's a democratic thing.
Right, yes.
And it's a human being thing.
Yes.
It's not really political. It's humanistic. We have to hang on and have control over our, you know, creative outputs, because it's the only way in which we will push back against having everything, or lots of power and democracy removed from us. And it's been, when Keir Starmer signs up to this, he's signing away his democratic power, actually, in a weird way, because it's about, it's just about enormous wealth ripping us all off. And not paying us, you know.
And why isn't there courage to stand up against this?
I don't know why there's not political courage. There's lots of courage in the arts to speak up.
Yeah, there is.
Speak up,
I mean,
about
a lot
this.
Of noise being made about this. A lot of people saying how ridiculous this is. You know, where is our backbone?
There's a nice story which highlights all this, which came about yesterday, which is Taylor Swift buying back her,
yes,
the rights of her albums, her early albums. That's what we've got to do. We've got to hang on to our creative shtick. Also, it does tie itself into this idea of the art room, Mandy Barrett's art room. I don't want to go on about this endlessly,
yeah,
but the Mandy Barrett art room is about human intelligence. It's about really what she's doing is saying to the kids, develop your human intelligence, and that will give them power in this new world of AI, because the conventionally clever child is going to be a bit screwed.
Yes.
Because
yes,
if you're really great at maths and you think you're going to be an accountant, that job is going. If you're really great at English and you're an argumentative person, you think you're going to be a lawyer, those jobs are going. It's only the kids who can see across the silos of the subjects and see the possibilities and can imagine new futures which will be empowered. But our blooming government is undermining them, you know, with the by giving their power away to the AI oligarchs, if you like. So we got to stop that. It's not, you can see it's not good for America, and it's becoming pernicious in this country as well. We got to stop the people who own social media platforms from running the show, you know.
The world.
Yeah.
I'm going to come towards the end of this podcast now and ask you a final question on a more sort of positive, I suppose, note. But just to finish off that last bit on AI, it makes me think about the child who drew the trams and the trains,
yeah,
right? And because that is exactly the skill we're talking about.
Yeah.
Seeing outside what the curiosity took that child to drawing the trams and the trains. It's not what they were asked to do, but it was within the thing. That is exactly what we're talking about. And if we didn't have this point system, score,
it's imagination.
It's imagination. And that's what we've got to cultivate. That is the thing that will invent the jobs outside of the AI, et cetera, et cetera. Or using AI, but being part. It's such a narrow way of thinking that we're thinking at the moment. And it's, as you said, it's dangerous as well. But to end on a more positive note, we said before that people are immersed in the arts, whether they understand it or not, you know. And you've said that, and I completely agree. We're in the arts, you know, by being alive and being outside. And I see and meet so many people who say they're not creative. They haven't got a creative bone in their body, is the phrase. It can be things we don't even think about when we think about the arts. And I know you feel the same, you know, cooking a meal, juggling the demands of work and childcare and being present in our homes. You know, everything is, it's the way in which we view it. Do you think we all underestimate how creative we are in our day to day? And I wonder what you would say to someone who says, I haven't got a creative bone in my body.
Well, I would say to them, art, you know, is a bit like love. because, you know, art, you know, we have these, beware out there, folks, there are people who call themselves artists, but calling yourself an artist is a bit daft, because it's a bit like saying, I'm a lovist.
Yeah.
Because art depends primarily on dopamine and kind of the enthusiasm that that creates. And it is very like love. Art exists between us just like love exists between us. And so whether you like it or not, art is just... Is at everybody's fingertips, and creativity is at everybody's fingertips. Pencils are cheap, bits of paper a bit more expensive, but they're fairly cheap. And I would encourage people to just draw something, just look at something, something that you're interested in, something that you love. Maybe think about a piece of music that you really love, and just try and picture how it might look or how it does look. If you're really into plants and gardens, just draw a rose, or, you know, draw a hydrangea or something, you know. And actually, by doing it, you're studying it and you're synthesizing that information. And that's important for us. Mm. That's important for us to do it. And you'll have an heirloom that you can hand on.
Mm. Thank you so much. I've just gone through so many questions I wanted to ask you, but we've run out of time. And I use this analogy in this podcast that, you know, the journey that we're going through and what you've been doing, and the just honestly, just, oh, you've just got, if you had a very big fan before, now I'm bursting. Tell me, if you were on a roller coaster and you were in your carriage with your, you know, amazing slogans on the side of your carriage that you would have signed painted onto them, what would you say has been a low, one of your greatest lows in this journey?
I don't have loads of regrets, really, but it's not been a greatest low, but I wish I had started playing the piano when I was younger.
Really? I see it behind you, and I can see that that is a very good piece of music there, which means that you're pretty good.
Well, I'm learning that, Ginopoli, so excited. But I really wish I had started this journey a lot. I mean, I love playing music. I love playing the piano, and I write lots of songs. I've written lots of songs for children about the arts, which I'm working on at the moment, which we've recorded actually, and we do stuff with. And you know, every Wednesday I go to the local pub and do the open mic night and play children's songs.
which pub?
A bit inappropriate. It's the Queen Charlotte in Addington Street in Ramsgate.
Oh my
Wednesday
goodness!
Night is open mic, and I love that because I can get. I mean, I used to play in bands a lot, but now I live in Ramsgate. It's not quite.
Yeah.
The possibility to do that's quite so much. But I love going to the open mic night and play. And I wish I'd done that a bit earlier. I mean, that would be my only real regret. I mean, I haven't had any terrible... you know, we all go through very difficult times, don't we? But like medical things and stuff like that. But actually, I haven't had any great disasters, I don't think. Luckily.
Well, I'm so pleased to hear that. What would you say... with your cap off and the wind in on the top of your head, I don't know if there's much hair underneath there, and in the roller coaster. And what would you say one of your greatest highs has been?
Oh, well, that is very clearly for me. Painting and exhibiting the interview with David Knott. I met this, I listened to a Radio 4 interview about, which was an amazing surgeon being interviewed by a wonderful journalist, Eddie Mayer. And it kind of changed my life. I painted it. I thought, I don't want this interview to go away. He had been a surgeon in Aleppo during the height of Assad's campaign. And he'd been stitching everybody together, you know, people who would kill him if they realised that he was a British citizen. Mm-hmm. And and mothers and children. It's a heartbreaking interview. And in the middle of it, it gets so, I won't go into it, but it gets so gory, really, that Eddie Mayer cracks up. He can't continue, but then he gets himself together. So there was radio silence in the middle of it. Anyway, I painted this painting. And I exhibited it in the Royal Academy. I hadn't told them, but they did a piece about it. And so I got to meet David. And but what has been amazing, that was about 10 years ago, but what was really amazing is that it wasn't until last year, I think, I sold it to the National Museum of Wales, and I've donated the funds after the HMRC got their share, but I've donated the funds to his charity. But it wasn't until I did that, and we did a piece for ITV about it, but he told me that he took his then girlfriend, he took somebody on a date to see the painting, Ellie. So their first date was to go and see this painting. And they got married. They've got two kids. And they set up the David Knott Foundation. And that's an unbelievable thing for me, because they work. I mean, they're a real example of the power of teaching, you know, sharing knowledge. They're teaching surgeons how to be generalist surgeons in war zones. And they're saving millions of lives. So that is definitely, I don't think I'll ever do anything as powerful as that again. It was an amazing thing to have done, and I really value my friendship with David and Eddie Mayer's. It was all dependent on Eddie Mayer's interview, really, but it was an extraordinary thing. Starlight Express or something, but they did go and see that painting and they got together, so that was amazing.
How beautiful. Well, but this has just been, I mean, I speak to everyone listening. I've just so enjoyed getting to know you today. And you remind us that creativity is inside of all of us, but also that it belongs to us, and that there's a lot of work for us to do, but we've got to come together. And I think one of the things I would say to anyone listening is, you know, please support Bob. What you're doing is so important, almost like crazily important. You know, when you actually, you know, stack it up to actually what you're representing, you know, you're representing like slightly saving the planet. But I won't put that on you, but I'm just saying that that is sort of, you know, the essence of you, and your voice and your art is an incredible force. And I thank you for existing. And I really thank you for being you. And I'm so privileged to have this conversation with you today. So thank you.
Oh, Holly, it's been a pleasure.
I'm going to hand over to this moment where I ask you to read something that you've prepared.
Yes, the letter to myself.
The letter to the young one sitting around that kitchen table. I don't know what age you've pitched this at, but I'm going to hand the microphone over to you.
Okay. All right, well, there's a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but I have done it.
Thank you.
Dear Patrick, for that is my real name. Dear Patrick, get some decent clothes. No one likes a scruff. Don't change your name to a brother and sister duo. No one will know why you did that, and it will cause confusion. Remember, there's no God, and you are an intellectual. Don't make funny art. No one will take you seriously. Only amateur artists get paint on their clothes. Look like something, but remember, only printmakers and TV presenters have twiddly moustaches and waistcoats. Don't overdo it, or people will think you have nothing to say. Don't borrow money to go on holiday. Get to grips with the piano. Do ask for help. Marry an Italian. Then you and your kids can forget about Brexit and have nice holidays meeting your extended family, and the food is good. Speak at least two other languages and get to Paris whenever you can. Listen to what others are telling you. Stay visible. Try to tune in a bit more. Mind the paintwork. Go to the pub and discuss art with your pals. Don't be such an arrogant git. Take money making and business a bit more seriously. But without you, I wouldn't be me. And it does work out. So begrudgingly, thank you. And thank your sisters, Vicky and Charlotte, and your mum and dad for me.
Just thank you. Thank you for sharing that with us. And thank you for doing what you're doing. And please, never even, and I think you don't have dark moments, but if you do, can you just know that we really need what you do, and we are right behind you all the way. And thank you so much for dedicating yourself to such an important thing on behalf of us all. So thank you so much for being on this podcast.
Oh, well, thank you, Ollie. It's been great. I've really enjoyed it, and all power to you.
Thank you. Thank you for joining me today. If you've enjoyed this episode, can I ask that you share it with a friend and like, subscribe and review it too, so that together we can inspire even more people to follow their dreams, to build a life they love.